Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. We're going to be talking about data analysis.
Well, it's a step prior to that, actually, Chris. It was a question I got a couple of days ago, or a couple of weeks ago, actually, and I'm looking forward to getting a chance to chat with you about it. But it's the question essentially is I have this data set, and I'm doing research and looking at books and stuff like that, but I'm really confused as to which method I should use, what approach should I use, what kind of analysis I should do. And of course, they didn't say in the first message why they were looking at this data and for what purpose, what's the analysis about. And it turns out it was on a test system, and they have this, he didn't identify what exactly this unit was, but they called it Unit 1, and they had 5 units all together. And the system itself uses a unit like this. All 5 units are essentially identical, and they get put into a system, but it's kind of the weakest link in this overall system. So he was interested in, I want to understand the reliability of these units so that I can proactively replace them when we have scheduled downtime rather than running to failure. I said, okay.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Sounds noble. Yep.
All right. So I thought, well, run 20 of them to failure and plot it on a Weibull curve and or whatever distribution, and you're off and running. And he goes, well, the units themselves are repairable. And so is it safe to put them back into the system treated as good as new? So instead of the old unit one, it's unit 1-1, it's, repaired one time. Or is it treated like unit 6? Is it as bad as old, where I keep the accumulated time from its first failure and start at that point and then keep going? Or do I treat it as good as new, where it starts at 0 once I put it back in service? And I said, we only have 2 in this. So the data set, I think there's 7 failures that occurred. And 2 of the units had been swapped back into the system that had been taken out as failures, repaired or refurbished, and then put back into the system when they got pulled from spares again. So it's and he has time to failure for each unit. So the first one ran, say, for 150 hours, the second one ran for 80 hours, and so on. It's time frames like that. And I thought, there's 2 questions there. What approach do I use? And then that key assumption, as good as new or as bad as old. And then how do you deal with the refurbished units? How do you treat them, as good as new or as bad as old? That kind of stuff. So I thought, My first response to him back was, well, keep doing what you're doing until you get more data. You'd be better shape.
Right.
But I also thought, I got to talk to Chris about this, because these 2 questions are tough.
Right. And I've seen many PhD theses that have tried to attempt to analyze what they call the general renewal process, where you have good as old, good as new, factors that give you something in between.
Yeah.
And one of the problems is that, I mean, this is part of my... I've been posting about this on LinkedIn a little bit recently, but also for my next webinar is going to be about the Waddington effect, where it's been every data analysis that's been published on this issue has shown that every time you conduct maintenance, the failure rate or the hazard rate goes through the roof temporarily, regardless of whether it's preventive maintenance or corrective maintenance. Every time you touch a system, you do something to the rest of it. So The reason why it's called the Waddington effect was because it was identified during World War II by this gentleman named C.H. Waddington. And he identified in Bomber Command that the instances of maintenance per flight hour for the aircraft was highest in the first 10 flying hours after servicing. And then it went down a little bit for the between 10 and 20 hours after servicing. Then it went down even more between 20 and 30. Then it went down even more between 30 and 40. Then it went down even more between 40 and 50. And after 50 hours, it was serviced again. And
if it's running, don't touch it.
Exactly. From a statistical perspective, and this is what's really challenging, is it shows that when you have that continually decreasing hazard rate after servicing, by definition, every failure that's occurring in those 50 hours is dependent on maintenance. And the reason why I referenced the gentleman by name, Waddington, is because he was a biologist. So he wasn't an engineer who has been brainwashed like us, where we always, it's without it being tacitly forced down our throat, or sorry, overtly forced down our throat, it has been tacitly forced down our throat that maintenance is good. That's it. Maintenance is 100% unambiguously good.
Well, I get that. If my brake pad is squealing at me and we replace the brake pads and they work better now, I get it. It's good. But the chance of my tire going flat has gone up. It's
right.
It's kind of what you're saying. It might be something else going wrong.
There's also a chance that when those brake pads are replaced, a mistake, no matter how trivial or how infrequent, has been made by the mechanic for the calipers and everything else around mm-hmm. the brake assembly, that there will be a non-zero probability that you're going to have a non-brake pad related issue when you drive your vehicle out of the servicing bay. And the reason that I'm talking about that is because I thought I was special because I rediscovered this, and I thought, well, you know, we gave this a name. I didn't name it after me.
Call it the Jackson effect. And well, damn it. Some guy way back when figured it out. He has a cooler name too.
Right. But he didn't name it after himself either. Another, it was named after him by somebody else.
Right.
But I found this for, like, when I was in the Australian Army, I analyzed every single ground-based vehicle we had. And I found that they had this decreasing hazard rate after every servicing event. For every vehicle, the only one I could publish about at the time because the OEM for that vehicle had gone out of business. Mm-hmm. And so sort of no commercial embarrassment associated with it. Since I've been consulting, whenever I analyze post-servicing or post-maintenance failure data, every single time I find that virtually every failure is driven or dependent on maintenance. And so why am I talking about that? Is because we're going back to this scenario where you're asking, is this going to be as good as new, as good as old, or somewhere in between? What muddies the water is that whenever you repair something, which is obviously what you need to do if something breaks, but whenever you repair something, you add this additional set of failure mechanisms associated with the maintenance action itself, and the hazard rate goes to the roof initially, and it goes down over time. But if you're trying to conduct data analysis to characterize if it's as good as old, as good as new, even if it's as good as new, it's going to be temporarily worse than new until it reverts back to being roughly as good as new, because you always have this post-maintenance-induced failure mechanisms.
But that's, there's two levels to this, though, Chris. There's the system that they're replacing this unit in and out of. It's probably taking on some damage in and of itself, but that's didn't seem to be part of this question or study. But I'm sure it applies there too. And then within the unit itself, when it goes off to the shop and gets repaired, assume it's a pump, right? Then it might be the liner's not set up correctly, or the seals are misaligned, or the bolts are not as torqued quite correctly when it's reassembled or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It could be some, like you said, a hard to detect minor error that increases the variability, leading to one or more different types of potential failure mechanisms increasing in their opportunity to occur. And you put it back in the system, and if the dominant failure mechanism, and I never did get an answer back on, is it always failing for the same thing? So that might be an interesting way to look at this, which also begs the question of what kind of analysis to do on it. But so what are you saying? Is that is put a decreasing failure rate that's temporarily higher than a good as new unit, or something else?
Yeah, the best case scenario is that you'll have a good as new unit, but you'll have a overlaid on top of that a period of maintenance induced failure. You're always going to have that. So yeah, it's not just as simple as being able to analyze and find out what's going on. You have to be able to either look through that, which is actually involves quite sophisticated data analysis.
Yeah, and with two data points, we can get an infinite number of answers, I'm sure, from that.
That's right. And so that's just part of it. So the original question, as I understand it, is we want to understand the failure characteristics of something so that it can inform a decision to repair it during downtime. Is that right?
Replace it before it failed, before it takes the system offline.
Right.
Or replace it. It's replace it. And then it's that sparing strategy is take it onto the bench, refurbish it, repair it, and then put it back in spares.
Right. So that rotable, that's a component or part or whatever it is, you know, if it was to be made as good as new, you would expect that there would be some additional, that set of components or parts, you'd expect there to be some period of maintenance-induced failure rate, at least initially thereafter. Yep. And so it doesn't mean you shouldn't use them. It means that they would be, let's call it, from a configuration perspective, could be as good as new, but they're going to be at least temporarily tainted by your repair effort. Just there's nothing you can do to avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I have no idea how to model that or you know, take that into account until he gets more data to even know, is it significant for them or not? You know, if it's a 20% increase in a failure mechanism that is not going to happen before the primary failure occurs, then it's as good as new from their perspective. But if they do 100 of these and 20 of them fail within 2 hours after putting in the service, then they got to figure out this secondary distribution form.
The other question I'd ask is, okay, so it's repairable. So what happens if you decide to remove one of these components during scheduled maintenance times or at a scheduled interval? It hasn't failed. What do you do with it then? How do you repair something that hasn't failed?
It's not enough detail in the discussion about what the type of unit it is in, you know, with the failure mechanism, much less is it the same thing happening every time. But you can imagine that if it's, say, a lining or a seal that's wearing, that is degrading in some fashionable way, an inspection would say, yeah, it hasn't failed yet, but it's in pretty bad shape. You gotta replace it. As opposed to an electronics box that's all coupled together and sealed together, and you put it on the bench and it looks just fine. There's no degradation. There's no loss of timing or no indication of anything wrong. I wouldn't go in and replace components, and because that's what we always do. I'd say, nope, let it run. But I got to know the mechanisms of what's going on, and that didn't come through in the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be to the point where, like you said, well, it hasn't failed. How do you repair it? But you might be able to pull it off and rectify the damage that would ultimately lead to failure. But yeah, there's a little bit more.
But you have to know how to see it or detect it, that damage. If it's inside the dielectric layer on a capacitor and you can't measure it, then it's a mute point. I can't see it. I I suspect it's there, but it only occurs in 10% of the capacitors. So do I replace all of them to get rid of that 10% one that may be degraded? Those are all trade-offs and, you know, budget and everything else. But I think the idea that I missed it completely is, you know, if you repair something, you're more than likely are going to have this extra problem going on with it. See Waddington et al. and paper.
Well, it's I find it such an interesting topic because so much engineering focus is all about the accumulation of damage, wearing out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a valid part of reliability engineering and engineering more broadly. But the whole idea of, hey, let's do less maintenance and improve reliability, which is essentially better than something for nothing, it's just so hard to have that concept gain traction in the world of asset management or reliability engineering. Again, some of the posts I put on LinkedIn about it, people have said, I've never seen that. You need to prove that it exists. And I essentially said, challenge them. A lot of people agreed. A lot of people were on board. But my challenge to them was, well, prove it doesn't exist, because I've just given you some charts of data analysis that's been conducted. Do you have a chart? Where's the data you've analyzed where you haven't found this immediate increase in the hazard rate after a maintenance action? And that's where the comments stopped.
Yeah, I may have some of those laying around. When I work with escalators, there is the different technicians. I mean, each tech, and part of it was they had different brands of systems and different maintenance tasks they had to do and different levels of access and number of steps and stuff like that. So it wasn't by any means a controlled experiment, but the text that they sent me out to the field with to see how they did maintenance, they deliberately picked ones that were, these people were really good and really passionate about doing a good job of what they're doing. And when I got all the data set, you know, of all the reported failures of those particular systems, they do maintenance and there were no failures until they came back and did the maintenance. And it was mostly a lot of safety checks and a lot of cleaning of sensors type things, the optic sensors that they had, lubrication type system steps, stuff like that. And the really good techs did way more diligence in the cleaning and you know, just care of the equipment versus I finally got them to send me out with some people that really didn't want me out there watching them, because then they had to figure out how to do what they're doing. The kind of the ones the data showed were the worst of the worst. And when they did a maintenance step, it was very likely that there was a failure within an hour of them buttoning it back up. So I've seen it both ways, but I've also seen it when you really take care of your equipment and it's just pristine and you can spot any issues with it and you have the skill and capability to deal with those issues and set them right. And that equipment just ran like better than when it was first commissioned, because it had broken, it was broken in, it was just purring. And the tech was very proud of that outcome. Whereas these other ones, it was, I just get paid, you know, whether I do anything or not, kind of a approach. And then, so it was, what's the motivation? And in some cases, my own experience, and I have to find that data set, because that might be the exception to the Waddington rule. But I get it. It's the going in and touching something. Even in an inspection, just hooking up a cable to it or unplugging something and getting access to something like that infinitely increases the chance that cable is bent. It's going to wear the insulation, it's going to short, it's going to allow moisture into it, it's not going to get reseated correctly, it's damaging the pins themselves and the sockets. The normal force isn't as strong anymore because of the exercise. It just multiplies, and it's a connector, and it can cause all kinds of havoc in your system, and they're very hard to diagnose. So it's like,
yeah.
And we only use the connectors because we want to be able to maintain that unit. We need to access to it. We need to pull it out or put it back in. If we didn't have to do that, there'd be no connectors.
Right.
So what do you suggest? Just make perfect ones and never and don't make it a repairable unit?
No, I mean, of course, all we're doing is throwing up problems for our yeah. question asker. I think it just comes back to, I mean, when you don't have a ton of data, which appears like that's the case.
In this case, yeah.
Yeah, I just come back to just look at the failures and do an RCA on the few failures that have occurred and really try and understand what you can do to address the failure mechanism. Not look at the statistics as much, especially if you don't have that many mm-hmm. or that much. Maybe just go back to, is it corrosion? Is it fatigue? What is it? Well, I mean, and then that can help you inform design changes or operational changes, or if it's corrosion, then okay, well, we know we can understand the humidity. That can then inform preventive actions, et cetera. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I also suggest that is you need to understand the failure mechanisms. One, if they're all the same fundamental mechanism, say corrosion, then they're the viable may be the right. It's an accumulated damage model. It's and eventually somewhere in that system that corrosion gets to a critical level and then you have a failure. Or is it just the presence of a certain amount of corrosion that you call it a failure? Maybe it's continuously inspected. We don't have a lot of details. But if it's a cable or a connector failed or a timing circuit went haywire for two cycles and that's called a failure or whatever, if it's different every time, then I don't really think a Weibull analysis is, it gives you some information at a system level, but it's not going to help you solve what's going on or set a maintenance schedule for it because you got 15 plus failure mechanisms at play, maybe more. And if so, you don't know which one's going right. to come up in any particular circumstance. And so my first thought to him was, you know, I hesitated to say, well, you could use Bootstrap on the limited data set you have and, you know, simulate that you get more data and get try to model a distribution on it. But you still don't have a lot of information. And we really need to answer, is it always the same fundamental mechanism? And then I think Bootstrap would give you a shortcut to go further with this. But the repaired units coming back into system, that throws another whole wrench into it. And there's, with only two data points here, I don't even think Bootstrap would help you in that case.
But, yeah, be cautious. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I think the end of the day is what's the real purpose? You know, what's its overall context and we need more information. So it's an interesting problem. How do you deal with these things? And is it as good as new or as bad as old? Well, yes and kind of no.
Yeah.
It guarantee that it's going to have some auxiliary damage is going to occur that will increase some probability of these other mechanisms that you're not expecting and get more data to figure that one out. That's going to be the fun part. So, but anyway, it's an interesting question. I went back and forth with him a little bit on it. I'll send him some more info. And hopefully by now he'll have like a dozen more failures and he can head off to the Weibull Plus and have fun. But it's still got to have a purpose. So hopefully we'll get some meaningful information out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, again, I think until you have a lot of data, just my advice is to be hesitant to rely on statistics. Look at the physics of failure and see what you can learn at a case-by-case study.
Yeah, I agree. So if you're dealing with a big data set or a small data set or interesting failure mechanism, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go. I think I said that right. And there's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Chris and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our About pages. So plenty of ways for you to send over a question. You can sanitize it so it's not proprietary, but we'll still ask probing questions to figure out more. Hopefully get you moving in the right direction and most likely then talk about it on one of the upcoming episodes. And I think I we're going to run, I just talked to Mijan recording, and we did a listener question there, and she got a question from somebody separate from that. And I've got this question for you. And Chris, if you can record another one, we got another question coming up. So we'll have a string of four listener type questions to deal with. And I hope that process continues.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.